I have to begin by saying that I can't believe this has never hit me, this gospel, in the way that it just did during that reading, even through my study and you know, all the years of ministry. I was reminded that at my wedding, we ran out of wine. But really, it was out of champagne because we had one of those fountains, you know, and all my fraternity brothers drank all of the champagne. We had to actually tip the bowl up enough just to get a little in my glass and Trish's glass so we could have a little toast. And it just kind of cracked me up. When we were leaving to go to the airport for our honeymoon, one of the cars screeches up, and one of my fraternity brothers comes out with bottles of champagne, and they're running in to try to put some more in the fountain. But it just hit me. It just cracked me up. I was like, I remember that. Why have I? That has never crossed my mind when reading this scripture before. Let's set the scene a little bit. You know, Cana was a village, a small village. And when the villages, most of them, the little ones out and about, they're not quite sure where they actually were, because they were so small. They might know that some little something was over here and some little something was over here. Cana is one of those little villages, and they think it's nine miles north of Nazareth is their guess, but it's just because of the size of it that they don't really know. What we do know from the Gospels is that Cana was the home to Nathanael, which I think is funny, because Nathanael was the disciple who questioned Jesus being the one that they had been waiting for when he asked the question, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" And here, he's the one who said that, asked that, and Jesus, in Nathanael's home village, showed his first sign in the Gospel of John. So it's almost like one of those, "Let me just show you, Nathanael. Yeah, we're going to your place for a wedding." Yeah. I also think it's important to be reminded about biblical marriage. It's important to understand how that worked, to really understand what is underneath today's gospel. Because biblical marriage, it's one of those terms that gets thrown out and tossed around a lot about how living into biblical marriage and all those things. Well, biblical marriages were not about relationships between two people. They were not about a bride and a groom. Biblical marriage was about the relationship between two families. And the groom's father would purchase the bride for his son. Sometimes they may not have even known each other. And sometimes the age was extremely different. And most often, when that purchase happened, the bride was too young to leave the father's house. So she was that young. And so they stayed, she would have stayed in the father's house until she reached age. Okay, and so that purchasing part is called a betrothal. We know that word from Mary being betrothed to Joseph. That's the legal part of it. That's the purchasing part of it. Now, when the bride was old enough to leave her father's house, they would make the trek to the other family's house, to the dad's house, which is actually where the married couple is going to live almost always. They don't have their own house. They come into under the father's roof and be there. And this would have been kind of a caravan. You know, when the bridal party is coming, we've heard about that in the scriptures too, when the bridegroom and moving through. And so this kind of parade would be going down, and it would be their family and their friends headed down to the groom's father's house. Now, when they got there, the bride would be taken into the marriage bed to consummate the union. Now, during that, they had to show proof that she was pure. If she was pure, then the actual wedding feast began. Typically, this feast lasted a week. Not like our one-day little party that we have, afternoon, a couple hours, whatever it is. No, this was a big deal because it wasn't about two people. It was about two families. And when two families came together with such a marriage, it was going to benefit both of them. There was a reason that those two dads came together and said, yep, this needs to happen. And so, to get invited to it, really it was family and friends, though there was also an element of a neighborly relationship. And so really know that because Cana was so small, everybody had a neighborly relationship. And so it was like the whole town would have been there, not to mention outside family and friends. Now, the family and friends of the groom, part of their honoring of the family was to bring food and wine to the party to help supplement what the groom's immediate family could provide, because one family could not provide for everybody. It took the extended family to do that. Now, the female family and friends of the groom, one of the ways they honored the families is that they're the ones who served in the kitchen. They helped prepare food, get it ready, serve food. This is why Mary would have known they were out of wine, because the women were in the kitchen and they ran out, and they would have known that. Now, running out of wine at my wedding was not that big a deal, really. It was a nice, small, simple little wedding. It did embarrass the responsible fraternity brothers of mine who ran off to try to make amends for that, but it wasn't really a big deal. But for this wedding, and for weddings in this time and this place, it was horrible. Running out of wine would have been brought such shame to the groom's family. And really, more than that, it dishonored the bride's family. You've dishonored them by not having this outward visible sign, actually of life and harvest is the wine. It's that outward visible sign of that. And so you're dishonoring the bride's family. You're dishonoring this brand new union. Let's start this relationship off with such dishonor. No one wants that. Not having enough wine meant that you were too poor to support the party, which meant you were really, were you going to be able to support the bride? And either you had lack of friends, and that wasn't good either. So we pick up today, and Mary comes to Jesus, and she says simply, they have no wine. Jesus' reply often gets a chuckle. Woman, what concern is that to you and me? Now, to you and me, that sounds a little disrespectful, right? A little offensive. I know that if I said that to my wife or my mother, backhand, you know, or something, right? I would have been put in my place. But in that time and that place in the Middle East, the bond between mother and son is the closest interpersonal relationship that could be had. The closest interpersonal relationship in the Middle East. Even closer than husband and wife. Because husband and wife often didn't even hang out with each other. They didn't know each other. Young girl, old man. You know, those sorts of things. The relationship wasn't always there for that married couple. So mother and son, the most intimate of relationships. So, having that being said, woman, we hear it one other place in the Gospels. The other place Jesus says, woman, and then continues, was this when he's hanging on the cross. And he says it then to his mother and to the beloved disciple, woman, this is your son. To the disciple, this is your mother. So it wasn't out of disrespect. It was just part of the way things were. He was making sure that his mother was taken care of, even in his death. And so, after Mary telling Jesus, she kind of put him in his place too, just looking to the stewards and saying, do whatever he tells you. Jesus, in doing that, honors his mother, but it's more than that, because if it had been found out later that he could have done something about it, and he didn't, he chose not to, that brought dishonor on everybody as well. And he knew this. So he honors his mother and honors his gifts. Now, to do that honoring, we learn from the scriptures that there were 6 stone jars that were 20 to 30 gallons apiece. That's 900 bottles of wine. We think, oh, 20, 30 gallons. No, 900. That's something we can visualize, right? 900 bottles of wine. That's more wine than they would have consumed the entire week. And Jesus offers that to them later when they run out. Jesus not only saves the bridegroom and the family from shame and the loss of honor, Jesus actually gives honor by making the wine superior and being so abundant. Wow, look at all this and how great it is. He gave them honor. Now, it is as a friend that Jesus is willing to save the honor of those in need. That's what the listeners of John would have heard, because they understood that layer, an element of the culture that we don't necessarily go right to. We think, wow, a miracle, water to wine, that's wonderful, it must be God. This is what they hear. They hear this friend willing to save the honor of other friends and other family. Because they lived in fear of persecution. In following Jesus, John's listeners would have left behind all the relationships that gave them security and honor. They needed to hear those words. Is that why John's gospel opens up with it? It sets the scene for the entire gospel about Jesus making this offering. Often the gospels are seen as a roadmap for salvation from sin and eternal death. Often seen that. Now, forgiveness and reconciliation are of great importance in our lives, but Jesus gives us something else in this first sign of glory. What Jesus gave to those listeners and what he gives to us is an example of grace. They experienced grace. Jesus did what was in his power to protect the dignity of others. He offered grace to protect them from shame and dishonor, which to those listeners was everything. And not only that, he did it with such great abundance. He offered not only the minimum, which he could have. I don't know what the magic number was. 50 bottles of cheap wine. Because that's what was expected. There would have been no honor lost. It would have been perfect. But no, what he offers was true to him, which would be the best and the most abundant and the most superior, 900 bottles of the finest. What do we have to offer? In our epistle reading from 1 Corinthians today, Paul says, to each is given the manifestation of the Spirit for the common good. We've all been given something from the Spirit that we can offer to others that will create community, healing for the common good. What is it that you have to offer? It doesn't have to be necessarily this specific list that Paul offers us, right? We're all given some sort of gift, even from the simplest of a smile, because we all know the power of that. We have something to offer. And I think when we offer what we have to offer in our hearts and in God's eye, what we have offered is grace to others that is superior. Amen.